Good morning, everyone. I will make a start so that we've got quite a lot of speakers. welcome and thank you for coming. You may want to come closer to the front if you want and sit next to someone, someone new. So thanks for coming. I'm Claire from the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives, and I'm a librarian by day. So I spend a lot of time thinking about catalogues and searching them. So I'm very looking forward to this subject, which is the internet and web-based collection management session in the digital practice stream. There are a few more to go in this stream, and there will be three presentations for around 18 minutes each, with 30 minutes of discussion at the end. So I will get into it. The first one, I'm going to keep it brief, and you can find out more about the presenters in the program. But Richard Keeble is first with Opening Up to the World, Moving to Web-Based Collection Management System. And he is from the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives too.
Thank you for the introduction, Claire. So, for those who aren't aware, the Australian Lesbian Gay Archives is located in Melbourne, Australia. We were founded in 1978, so we're now into our 41st year. We're volunteer-run, and we're funded mainly by donations. So, ALGA's collection, that's a rough idea of what we currently have. We have around about 26,000 catalogued items, and I realise different archives use different figures for what counts as a catalogued item. This is over about 550 shelf metres, and the catalogue is currently in Excel spreadsheets and Word documents. A small proportion of what you can see on the screen there has had digital representations made of it. That could be JPEGs or PDFs or whatever is a suitable representation. In 2015, Monash University partnered with ALGA investigating digitisation and online accessibility for community archives. The original aim of the exercise was to get ALGA's catalogue online and to be able to run online exhibitions. The project's been known by two names, Digital Dilemmas originally, when it wasn't sure when we would be successful, and Project Monty later. Project Monty is a more positive name, named after Monty Punchin, who's a celebrated out Australian lesbian who died in 1989 at the age of 106. At the time of the project, it was believed that the catalogue would have to stay in spreadsheets because of the volume and the complexity of the data and the lack of expertise and the lack of resources within the organisation. But for an IT person like me, this isn't a particularly novel problem. But you do need IT expertise to be able to transfer your data from spreadsheets to another system. So I wasn't involved in ALGA at the time, and there is the question, well, how do you find skilled recruits within an archive? And ALGA found me through Facebook. I'd subscribed to a number of Facebook groups, and through that I found ALGA. I joined the project after it had started, around about the third workshop that had been held. So if you're going to do something like this, well, what might a project look like? And that's what I'm going to talk about here. What does an IT project to achieve these sorts of things look like? And it is a cyclic sort of thing. This is the cycle that we followed. It goes through multiple steps, which I'm going to go through individually. The steps aren't just in one direction. They go backwards and forwards. You might run a number of cycles of steps as well. We start with scope. Scope is working out what we want to do. So we had workshops where we established priorities and we worked out what our constraints were. The constraints were essentially zero budget, volunteer labour. As well as that, we performed a risk analysis, which I don't really have time to go into here, but it was worth doing because there were a number of risks. This is the scope that we established. We would get the catalogue data online. We would include existing digital representations, but we wouldn't create new ones. Our indexes and finding aids, which I'll come to, would be treated as attachments rather than embedded deeply into a database. and we would exclude online exhibitions, but we would make sure that we could perform online exhibitions. At the same time, we created a proof of concept system. Now, a proof of concept system was created in using a system called Omeka. Now, Omeka is a web publishing and content management system for digital collections and online exhibitions. It's open source, it's customizable, and it uses Dublin Core as its default metadata schema. Now, it's not actually a proper cataloging system, and there are many other more robust systems that exist. But it was very easily installed on ALGA's existing web host, and it's demonstrated in the time of the project that the project is feasible and it continues to be feasible. And it's also given a sense of progress as the project has proceeded. Next step is requirements. Well, what do we need from this particular system? Again, we did workshops for this. Some of the workshops, we used a specific IT process called use case analysis. I apologize to the translators for that part. And these are the requirements that we came up with. Data entry had to be easy. ALGA is staffed by volunteers. We don't have paid people to do this. We don't have the ability to extensively train people, and volunteers might not stay with us for very long. Discoverability is kind of self-evident. You want to be able to return good searches and so that searches will actually find what it is that's in your database. That also has to be easy to use. All of our existing metadata and our digital representations should be able to be captured within the project and by that system. And we have different types of metadata. You've got descriptive metadata, which describes the thing that you have in your catalogue, whether it's a book or a photograph or an item of ephemera. But you also have procedural metadata, and that might be things like the location of the item in storage, the provenance of the item, any action that might need to be taken with that item. We also have to be able to cope with all the different types of item formats that I showed you in the second slide. The cost of the system has to be very low. ALGA doesn't have a huge amount of funding, so we don't have tens of thousands of dollars to be able to spend on a system like this, and the cost has to be low both in setting it up and in the ongoing operation of the system. We don't want to have to be spending a large amount of money on annual license fees. Maintenance requirements have to be quite low because we don't have dedicated IT support people, and all the support staff will be volunteers. Additional functional requirements are that we have to be able to do a bulk data import. We have so much existing metadata, we can't enter it all again from the beginning. And we also want to be able to easily export the data from the system because we don't want to get into a situation where we are permanently stuck with a system that we can't escape from, even if the system's not working for us anymore. Lastly, there were quite a few data security requirements. Again, there are a little bit too much detail for me to go into in this presentation, but it's something that we thought very carefully about. Next step after gathering requirements was data analysis, which is getting an understanding of the structure and the content of the data that we already had. That's so that we can transfer it from the system that it's currently in to a new system. For that, we had workshops of expert stakeholders. So the experts were IT people like me and the people who really knew the catalogue. They were the people who built the catalogue over many decades of experience. I took that information away. I turned it into sort of IT speak, and then I presented that back to the group to make sure that I'd understood what was required. The data analysis was a very deep analysis of the data and its structures. We looked at the data's history, which tells us why we might be collecting the data. We're looking at the purpose of the data, the relationships between the different data in lots of different parts of the system, what the values of the actual data were. We identified controlled vocabularies, which some people might call name authorities. We looked at the quality of the data. We looked at whether or not it was complete, whether or not it was accurate, whether or not it was consistent. The catalogue itself identified this. There were 32 individual catalogue files. There were 31 Excel files. There was one Word file. Effectively, one file for each type of format that we had in the system. So periodicals were in kind of one file. T-shirts in another file. Books in another file, and so on. The digital representation, we had 160 finding aids, which are all Word documents, and we had 60 indexes, which are the formats that I referred to earlier, and we had tens of thousands of digital representations. The digital representations were held on a Windows desktop PC, which meant all of those were offline. They couldn't be accessed at all. The catalogue files are held on Microsoft OneDrive, which again are not available publicly, but there'd been a process of producing PDFs from those Excel files, publishing them on our website, which gave a little bit of catalogue searchability to the public. The analysis also revealed the really big problems that Excel presents for gathering catalogue data. It's too easy to enter data into Excel, which means it's too easy to enter wrong data into Excel. The final output of the analysis was a data dictionary, and you can see with great clarity exactly what went into that data dictionary. Each row in the data dictionary is one of the file formats. Each column is a metadata item. So this lists every metadata item that we found, and it shows the size of the project as well. So all the metadata items were grouped according to similarity. We found 781 metadata items. We found 35,000 records, which is a little bit at odds of our estimate of 26,000 catalogue items. This was also really useful for tracking project progress. With that snapshot, you can see that the green items are things that are complete, yellow items are things that are incomplete, and red items are problematic. Just so you know, that spreadsheet would probably run for another three screens horizontally. That's just a third of that spreadsheet. This also allowed us to evolve a comprehensive metadata schema for all of ALGA's formats. The next step was a data cleanse. So the analysis showed us that the data was not in a really good state for transferring to another system. A data cleanse process improves the data quality so that you can get it from an existing system into a new system. Now, this was a painstaking, time-consuming part of the project. It's still ongoing, and it's been, in terms of time, the biggest part of the project. In the data cleanse, we created and enforced standards, and that's doing things like making sure all of the metadata names are the same across files. We found around about 14 different versions of title metadata. So an object's title, depending on which format you were looking, could have had one of 14 different names. That needed to be fixed. Data formats needed to be consistent across all the files, so dates needed to be represented in the same way, regardless of format. People's names needed to be represented in the same way, regardless of format. There were a number of items of universal data that should exist in all of our formats, and they didn't, so they have been added in. We needed to make sure that controlled vocabularies, like place names or subject categories, were the same across all of our systems. We had to do things like consolidating formats that had been catalogued into multiple files into a single file. So, for example, periodicals had been catalogued in three different files, I think. They needed to be integrated all into the one place before you'd be able to export that to another place, to another system. Last of all was a spell check. Making sure your data is spelled correctly makes your data look quite a bit nicer. So the way we did that, some of it was done with software. So where the data was deterministic, we were able to write small computer programs. We used Microsoft Excel Formulae for that. We also wrote Microsoft Visual Basic programs using either Excel or Microsoft Access. And with Microsoft Access, we were able to use structured query language, or SQL, to be able to manipulate the data into a suitable format. We also used simple things like Microsoft Excel search and replace function, where we needed to replace lots of different values. Some of this work was done by individuals taking work home, working on it by themselves, but we also had things called data parties. The idea being, if you call something a party, it makes a really dreary task a lot more enjoyable than calling it a workshop. Each person had their own laptop, each person was assigned a different set of catalogue files, and everybody worked to get one particular metadata item in all of those files correct during all of those workshops we've had. I think we had two data parties, and there was cake. The social aspect of doing that dreary work together actually makes a lot of difference. The next two steps are data transform and load. These are pretty straightforward, but they do typically require IT expertise. So this is about making sure that the schema of your source data matches the schema of your destination data. This was pretty straightforward for us. We just had to rename the columns of our spreadsheets to have the same name as Dublin Core, which is what Omeka uses, export the data as CSV or comma separated value files, and then use Omeka's data upload function, which is a built-in function, which will just suck all of the data in and populate its databases. Other systems might need low-level database inserts to actually perform that sort of migration, which is why it requires IT expertise. You also need you need IT expertise to manage the failures, because invariably, the first time you try and import your data, there will be problems with the records which you need to go back and fix and repeat the process again. Another very important part of this is product research. You need to know what catalog you're going to select. We've found products in two ways: word of mouth, including at conferences like this, and online research, which should be no surprise to anybody. These are the products, most of the products that we've found or not found so far, with a bit of a heat map of what I like. We haven't selected a product yet. That's something that's still going on. To assess the products, you have to examine them really closely, because very often marketing material will overstate a product's capabilities. Very often these systems will be targeted at one type of format only. So for instance, something like LibraryThing does books really, really well, but it only does books. Archive Space, I think, does collections really, really well, but it does libraries quite badly. And Alga wants a product that will cover all formats, because we really only have the resources to manage one system. We've used trial systems that are available online, which is the case for a lot of these products. You can put your own data into those systems, see whether or not the data will actually go in, and see how easy it is to get the data in, either record by record or in bulk imports. We've installed demonstration systems, in particular Omeka. We have our own Omeka system running and live at the moment, though it's not available for general public access. And we've also had vendor visits to be able to assess commercial software systems. One of the things that you need that's worth recognising with product research is that assessing products will actually change your scope and requirements, because it leads you to a better understanding of what the available systems can do. It's one thing to say, I want this particular function. It's another thing to realise that you're going to have to pay $100,000 to buy that function if you're a small not-for-profit organisation like Alga is. Omeka has revealed a lot of its weaknesses in its use. We know that it has security weaknesses. I have a feeling that there are faults in its search functionality that I haven't gotten to the bottom of yet. So actually being able to use something before you make the commitment to go with that product is quite important. The last step you reach is a finished system. Now, as I said, we're not there yet. We are still doing our data cleanse. We are still yet to select a product. This has taken us a long time. As I said, the project started in 2015, and we've had quite a few interruptions, and this is something that's been quite significant for our project. I didn't think it was going to take nearly as long as it has. We've had people involved in the project relocate city and had to leave for work. They had to leave the project. We've had people go on extended sabbaticals abroad and haven't been involved. We've had two people, including myself, who have experienced bereavements and have had to step away from the project for a period of time. Alga also had to relocate after the building that we were located in was sold, and we had to move out and move to another place. I wound up being one of two project managers for that, and that took me away from this project for at least 6 months. I'd estimate we've had around about 12 to 18 months of delay because of these interruptions with this project, and that's unusual for a commercial development. There are regularly delays in commercial developments, but they're usually able to be covered. Because we've had a project plan, we've been able to restart easily. And this is what we have achieved so far. We've been able to get to this stage on a very low budget. It has required a lot of volunteer hours, you do need your stakeholders engaged, and it does require IT expertise. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. And I should also say thank you to our interpreters and translators. So next up we have Barry Feit on challenges in digitizing and making the ILIA collection accessible on the internet. And he is a digitization officer at ILIA. In Amsterdam.
Well, guten Morgen, or good morning. So, my name is Barry Feit, and I'm a digitization officer at ILIA LGBT Heritage. ILIA is located at the Public Library of Amsterdam, the OBA, and on the picture, it's the building that is second left with, the beige color. I work for ILIA since April 2018. I want to tell you something about how our public is served. So we have an information desk on the ILIA Square, and that's on the third floor of the OBA. For perusing material, you consult our search engine because we do not lend material from our collection. Therefore, you have to make a list of items you want to see, and that are a maximum of 12 items. And you send that list to info@ilia.nl. And then one of my colleagues will contact you about when you can peruse the material. And also on that third floor, there is a changing exhibition. And at the moment, well, you can guess, 50 years Stonewall. And in the past, for instance, With Pride and No Land for Love. And I took some pictures of those exhibitions. And our back office, as it is in the basement, so we are in the dungeon or the closet. Well, I have 12 direct colleagues, but we all work part-time, except our director, Lonneke van den Honaert. And there are also 11 volunteers, and without them, well, we couldn't do the service we are giving our public. About our archive. Well, ILIA has 244 archives, and that are stored at the International Institute of Social History. That's also in Amsterdam. We have about 22,000 items imagery, and also about, well, I think 25,000 books, and that's non-fiction and fiction. But also videos, CD-ROMs, cassettes, records, and objects. And it's a total of 170,000 items. And on the slide, we see photos of two storages of ILIA at the OBA. But then there is also born digital and digitized material. And what's the difference? Well, born digital, that's not structured, as you can see on the picture in the left corner. And digitized material, most likely structured. And that, for instance, last year ILIA digitized four magazine titles called Dialogue, Diva, Homologie and Sec, and they are from the period 1965-1997. And then you can make your own workflow, and well, that's structured. So that's really a big difference. I made a digitization plan, and it's a five-year plan. And one of the things I hope I translated correctly is source management. So digitization is a separate component in the ILIA workflow. And our five-year plan is from 2018 to 2022. And our priority is to digitize fragile material. And that's first, such as magazines and audiovisual material, and also posters. But born digital, that's quite new for us, and also for other big archives and institutions in the Netherlands, and I think also around the world. Well, ILIA has a contract with the International Institute of Social History, I told before, for storage of the archives. And at the moment, we are talking about accommodating born digital archives under this contract. And I will come back on this. And then again, of course, the cost of digitization. Well, the basic principles in our digitization plan are digitization as a form of conservation and to publish the digitized content on the ILIA website if possible. To store our digitized material in a safe space. Well, and important hereby are the costs. There are two types of costs in digitization. The incidental costs for the production of digital files, but also the structural cost for maintaining and making the digital files available. These costs are mainly the cost of storage. Well, and I read that 1 terabyte, you have to think about 1,705 euros per year. So that's quite a lot. Well, what I said, we have three head points, so that was source management, source accessible, and visible and known. And sources accessible, well, that are copyrights and privacy issues, and that are important obstacles when making the collection available online. ILIA has a relatively young collection, and therefore a large part of the material can only be shown under conditions. And then you have the general data protection regulation, so privacy rules, and also the copyrights. Well, and then's the question, how can ILIA remove these obstacles where possible, or otherwise find the best solutions to deal with them? And at the moment, users have to get an account to see the digitized magazines. And if possible, ILIA shows thumbnails of items, if they are available. Well, and then you come to visible and known. And ILIA wants to show the collection in an attractive way on the website, taking into account the needs of the user. Well, and we have specified 5 different target groups, and that are researchers, LGBT and non-LGBT people with personal interest, NGOs, media, and policymakers and the government. And if I come back to digitization material, in the Netherlands we have a program called Metamorphose, and that's the National Program for Preservation of Paper Heritage. And this program is an initiative of the Ministry of Education and Cultural Science. And there, digitization is a form of conservation, that's the basic principle. So the images produced for Metamorphose must adhere to quality standards in such a way that they can serve as a replacement of the original object. So the originals are withdrawn from use after preservation. And there are different requirements for different types of material. And they are specified in the guidelines. And you can download them on their website. And, well, I can really say that it's worthwhile to do that. And here you see some items of our collection. Well, the preservation masters for images are in TIFF, and that's 330 dot per inch. So you have all the information on the digital image. And on our website, we have JPEG, and that's in low quality. So that people can see it, but you can not reuse them. And for magazines and grey literature, such as theses or scientific articles, we use metamorphose lights, whereby color accuracy is slightly less significant. And this also includes for books, newspapers, magazine, and handwritten material. So there are three standards in metamorphose, and it's high quality, light, and extra light. Halfway? Okay. If I come back on born digital, yeah, what is born digital material? Well, it can be a hard disk with material in it, or floppy disks, but also websites, or YouTube, Twitter, emails. Well, and as said before, we work together with the International Institute of Social History for the storage of our born digital archives. And ILIA can use the workflow of the ESH because ILIA is technically too small to do this on its own. And I also hope that we can maintain or can have such a partnership that's possible with sound and vision. So that's for our audiovisual collection. And then there's also the Royal Library that is collecting archives of, is collecting and archiving websites. So maybe we can make an entrance on our website to those websites with the LGBT entrance. Well, and I think that's also what I want to tell in my presentation, that partnership is a key word in this. And then you have also in the Netherlands the Dutch Digital Heritage Network. And that's a partnership that focuses on developing a system of national facilities and services of improving the visibility, usability, and sustainability of digital heritage. And the Royal Library, Sound and Vision, but also the National Archive, are key partners in this project, or in this network, I have to say. Now back to our website. This is our homepage, and I will show you some slides from the IDEA website to demonstrate about how it works at the moment. In the right upper corner, you see Zoek binnen de collectie, so search within the collection. And there's also an English entrance from our homepage. Well, I typed ALMS, and then you get 50 results. Then I clicked material type in the right, objects, and there's one object, and that's a key chord of the ALMS London. And if you click on the little thumbnail, then you see a bigger photo from this object in low resolution. Well, now you have to know that there is an object, but I hope in the future that we have an entrance on our website with material type, and also an entrance with magazines or grey literature and objects. But if you want to see digital available magazines, you have to get an account. And that's because of copyrights, and also because, well, sometimes there's explicit material in it. And this, we have another collection, and that's called Open Up. And that was an initiative of ILIA to reveal the history of LGBT emancipation and development in Central, Eastern, and Southeastern Europe. But that collection of magazines is integrated in the ILIA search engine, and therefore at the moment we have two PDF viewers. But here you see a magazine that's not from Open Up, but from our ILIA collection, Der Eigene. And at the moment ILIA has 17 magazines online that are not related to Open Up. And for German-speaking countries, there are also the magazines Courier, Newsletter, Pressedienst from the 50s, and Jahrbuch for Sexuele Zwischenstufen. Well, Most of our digitized magazines are at the moment only accessible at our digital library, and that's on the Ilya Square at the OBA, so you have to come to Amsterdam to see our digitized magazines. But coming back on this PDF, we want one PDF viewer in our search engine to make all our digitized magazines and gray literature available. And of course, you have to get an account. Well, we are also participating in Oorlogsbronnen, and if I translate it, that's the War Resources Network. And that's also a key project of the Dutch Digital Heritage Network I talked about earlier. And Ilya participates in this World War II portal with 816 items. And if you click on such an item, then you are automatically redirected to the Ilya search engine. Well, and I think that my colleagues are telling about career search, and that's, well, I think such same system. I don't know, but maybe. Well, that was what I wanted to tell to you. If you want to hear more about Ilya at ALMS, you can see that two of my colleagues are talking, and that's this afternoon and tomorrow morning. So I recommend them. And my last slide, well, my conclusion, well, keyword is cooperation and working together if possible, because, well, Ilya is a big LGBT archive, but in the heritage world we are small, so we have to look for cooperation with other institutions. Well, thank you.
It looks like we'll have extra time for questions. Speaking of cooperation and partnerships, we have three people presenting from one network. Up next on Queer Search. Yeah, did you want to come? So there's Andreas Brunner, Karina Klubauer, and Hannes Hake on Queer Search.
Yes, good morning from me too. Might seem a little excessive that there's three of us, but as we're here to represent a network, we thought it's good also to physically represent a network, and as two or only collaboration, maybe three, we thought would very well represent a network. So that's why there's three of us presenting this this project. So the project Queer Search, a joint online portal for LGBTIQ archives in the German-speaking world, is a project in the making. So we're presenting something that is in the planning stage, although some steps have been taken, but we cannot present any technical details as we've heard before, unfortunately, yet. So... I wanted to change with this. So in 2017, 20 members of German-speaking LGBTQ archives, collections, and museums from Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and the Netherlands, although they're not German-speaking, but they have German-speaking material at Ilya, as we just pointed out, met for the first time for a two-day workshop in Berlin. Benno Gammel from Initiative Queer Nations is also here, and I had organized this meeting to connect these different institutions and plan the creation of a joint online catalogue. To my own surprise, it was the first formal meeting of these German-speaking LGBTQ heritage institutions ever in 2017. Then last year in 2018, a second meeting took place with new institutions joining the workshop or the network. So what is the project all about? So the vision of Queer Search is to create an online portal where all the collections of these different institutions can be researched on one site to grant better access to these collections, to enhance the visibility of LGBTIQ heritage and history, and to develop a joint reference database. And of course, to this point also adds the networking of LGBTIQ archives to have more collaboration and exchange on a continuous basis. And something that I will point out later is also to discuss and work on German thesauri and the controlled vocabulary that we're using in these institutions. The model or example for this online portal was and is the online catalog for the German-speaking women's and lesbian archives, META, and the current project, the German Digital Women's Archives. Some of you might have heard Sabine's talk yesterday, which for us is a very great inspiration. So while German-speaking lesbian and female, bisexual and feminist archives are well connected and have an impressive online presence of their collections, this is not the case for gay and male bisexual archives and or trans collections in German-speaking countries. So the need to create a joint online platform to research different collections from the entire spectrum of the LGBTQ community became a necessity and presented this to us in the planning for a queer cultural house in Berlin. There's also a presentation on that, where lesbian, bisexual, gay, and trans archives were to move in together. So the idea is not to replace META or other online platforms, but to learn from their experience, to build new alliances and collaborations, and to enhance the visibility of German-speaking LGBTIQ collections online.
I briefly want to introduce some of the participating institutions. You already saw the pictures. These are all or most of the institutions who are taking part into the project or have an interest in participating in the future. And one is the Archive of the Other Memories of the Federal Foundation of Magnus Hirschfeld. You might have seen them around already. It's a contemporary witness project who does biographical video interviews of queer people. Another one is the Archive of Youth Cultures in Berlin. They have not so small collections, but they have parts of their collections are also about queer materials. For example, they have queer DIY fanzines. Another one, they also had, I think, two talks already, is the Feminist Archive Berlin, FFBITS. Quite an old archive who is documenting the women's and feminist movement, mostly from the 1968 onwards. And they're also part of META already, though they already have like this platform or reference database, which Hannes already mentioned. Another one is the Research Center for the Cultural History of Sexuality at Humboldt University Berlin, which Hannes is representing today. They have two collections, actually. They run a pilot project about an AIDS archive, and they also have part of an art collection of Naomi Wilczek's Erotic Art Museum in Miami Beach. Another one, maybe not so obvious one, is the Landesarchiv Berlin, the City and State Archive of Berlin. They have documents about the Department of Same-Sex Ways of Living. Also participating is the Magnus Hirschfeld Society in Berlin. They collect, as you might imagine, materials around Magnus Hirschfeld's Institute of Sexual Research. Another one is Schwules Museum Berlin, Gay Museum of Berlin, which where I work at. We collect mostly archival materials, but also art from the LGBTIQ cultures since the middle of the 80s. Eberskirchen Hirschfeld Center was also mentioned by Hannes. It's an association, basically, who plans to build a queer cultural center in Berlin and also physically kind of tries to connect queer institutions and archives of Berlin. And also mentioned because they initiated the first queer search workshop with the initiative Queer Nations, who tries to intensify basically research around sexualities and gender issues. So I would hand over.
So I go on now with the further institutions. The Spinnboden Lesbenarchiv from Berlin, which is, as far as I know, the oldest queer archive in the German language area. They collect, in their self-definition, everything by and about lesbians, with a special focus on collecting rare testimonies from the history of the lesbian movement. The Deutsches Digitales Frauenarchiv, German Digital Women's Archive, DDF, is an interactive specialist portal on the history of the women's movement in Germany. They digitalize their holdings to make it accessible to the public. Forum Homosexuality Munich was founded in 1999 by a group of lesbians and gays enthusiastic about history. The association has since been working on current cultural and scientific contributions and findings on the everyday life, culture, and history of LGBTIQ people in Munich. Already mentioned is the ILIA LGBT Heritage from Amsterdam. I do not want to go into more details. Yeah, from my organization, from Vienna Queen, the Center for Queer History in Vienna, we were founded 10 years ago, and we concentrate our collections on the queer history of Vienna and Austria. We are a research center currently still focusing on the Nazi persecution of homosexuals, and a mediation center that aims to popularize queer history with lectures and city tours. The Gay Archive Switzerland in Zurich was founded in 1993 and is also collecting testimonies of gay history from Switzerland or with reference to the country, and makes them available to the interested public. The Gay Lesbian Archive in Hanover, Germany, was founded in 1980, and it's a private archive. Gay Brandenburg Amico is also a project on memory and commemoration work by and for LGBTIQ in Brandenburg. The Center for Gay History in Cologne is also participating in the project, and it's planned also that Lesbian History Switzerland should be part of our group. What you see is that most of the participating archives and collections have in common is that they are community projects. Even if they are financed with state or municipal funds, they are independent and autonomous and are thus also part of the communities whose culture and history they collect and preserve. Unlike most US LGBTIQ collections, which are often located at university, our archives have developed their own criteria for their collection and activities, and that makes it not easy sometimes to bring them together.
Right, as diverse as the institutions might be, or archives, as diverse as the digital registration of data, which varies. Pardon? No, I don't think. Oh, we do. We have a slide. It's from the Schulhof Museum in our archive. Yeah, it varies from like Excel spreadsheets to database systems, so it's a very broad range of how we cover our collections. For the Queer Search project, it's kind of important to us to keep the conditions of participation as low as possible, which means that you should be able to participate even if you don't have a database system yet. The project can also help, or this is our kind of vision, help institutions to actually improve the level of coverage of materials and the software solution which we have in mind, which is also kind of modeled after Meta, the Meta catalog, will not need, for example, a compulsory shared thesaurus to be able to participate. A lot of our archives are also based on work of volunteers, and we don't have a lot of human resources to bring about this project. First, we would like to limit the project to German-speaking countries. A lot of our materials are from the German LGBTIQ scene, which brings about some language-specific challenges. Hannes might go into it later. How should the project look like, structure and finance-wise? Is it your point right now, or do you want to?
Oh yeah,
later.
I'll do that now.
You do it now.
So that's networking here. One side project of the Queer Search project has been the exchange about different thesauri of the institutions. So often the thesauri of LGBTIQ archives, libraries, museums, and special collections have developed independently from each other and are shaped by the history of the collections and the social and political movements connected to them. And the idea is to share the different thesauri and start an exchange on different indexing practices. So a working group is formed that will work first on the translation of the reduced version of the English Homosaurus, which Jack van der Wel and Walter Walker will present today, I think, tomorrow, to translate that into German and also to add German terminology that is not included in the Homosaurus. And so the long-term goal of this endeavor is to improve is to improve and change the language and terminology in German-speaking libraries and cataloging system more generally, because what I've put on screen there is a screenshot of the integrated authority file. In German, that's die gemeinsame Normdatei, or the universal authority file. So that is an international authority file for the organization of personal names, subject headings, and corporate bodies from catalogs. It is used mainly for documentation in libraries, but it's increasingly also used by archives and museums. The GND, the Integrated Authority File, is managed by the German National Library in cooperation with various regional library networks in German-speaking Europe and other partners. And the file's specification provides a hierarchy of high-level entities and subclasses useful in library classification and an approach to unambiguous identification of single elements. So it has really a huge impact, the authority file. And just to point out the problems of these files when it comes to terms of some of the terms and classifications addressing LGBTIQ lives and histories are quite problematic in our view and need to be changed because they have terminological challenges or problems or also represent derogatory views of homosexuality. So for example here, or just don't make sense, that's also a big problem. So here for example, we have the word homosexueller, which is the male homosexual. We do not have the equivalent, the female homosexual, the German word gay, schwul, is not being used because it says we should use men and homosexual to talk about gay people. So the word gay doesn't exist, schwul in German doesn't exist in the GND. So then you would think, okay, well, the equivalent should then be woman homosexuality, but actually no, the equivalent is lesbian love. So you have male homosexuality and lesbian love as the two equivalents. So there is no lesbian, or there is lesbian, but there's no homosexual, female homosexual. So, I mean, and this is just one of very, very many problems when we go into trans terminology. Also the question of the terms heteronormativity, heterosexism don't exist in the catalog. Homophobia is listed, but I mean, yeah, so there's very, very lot of problems. I'm taking too much time for this because this is one of my projects. A joint statement or proposal for changes of the integrated authority file by the German-speaking LGBTIQ archives, libraries, museums, and special collections would be a lot harder to ignore by the German National Library than if the institutions would do this independently, and I think that's one of the goals that we're going for.
How would we like to organize this network? We would like to found an umbrella association, hopefully end of this year or next year in Vienna, probably. And all of the participating institutions should be part of, but still keep their autonomy. Which I already said, we don't have enough financial or staff-wise capacities within the individual archives to bring about such a project. We would like to apply for grants. The first considerations are to apply at a federal level, maybe at federal ministries like the Federal Ministry of Culture and Media. And basically we are, do we have another slide? Yeah. What's the outlook and future plans? Yeah, found an umbrella association, apply for grants, and hopefully get a lot of money and getting the project started. Thanks for your attention.
Thanks.
Thank you so much, everyone. That was really, really great. I could talk about cataloging it all day. That's the language. But I wanted to, in the spirit of partnerships and collaboration and networks, I want to invite you all to spend 2 minutes. I think everyone's sitting near at least one person, pretty much. So just 2 minutes talking to someone else about and reflecting on the presentation, and maybe sharing your initial thoughts and drafting a working on a question to ask, because we do have quite a bit of time. We'll do 2 minutes, or you could, if you don't want to talk to someone, you can just write some notes and take the time. Hopefully that's
Thank you.
I hope you're having some good discussions. But now is the time to ask our presenters, which, yeah, I'm sure you will have lots of questions. Who wanted to go first? Well, maybe we can do it in three. I'll pick three to start with. So, yeah, if anyone wants to put their hand up. Alrighty. So, I think Nick.
Actually, I want to ask something about something that you guys haven't told us. It is about how do we preserve the digital archive at the moment? Because what we are doing now, actually, we are preserving a document that has been done before, and also documents and old documents, that kind of stuff. But we are talking about current situation, email, website, homepage, social media. It might be very important if we are seeing about within 10 years, 20 years later, and we're going to look back and we thought, okay, we didn't do that, so probably we should have do that. Now, how far? Because how important that kind of action, and what are we going to do to preserve that digital archive?
Simple answer to that question is we don't know. For an organization like ALGA, we have 41 years of analog holdings, and we will struggle to digitize that information. We have only just started thinking about how we would collect and archive born digital information. We will receive hard drives with gigabytes or even terabytes of information on them, and we, at the moment, we don't know how to deal with those. We sometimes get archives that have floppy disks in them. At the moment, we can't preserve those. We don't have the equipment to preserve those. When it comes to things like social media, at the moment, there's one small advantage, and that is if it's on Facebook, Facebook preserves it. And lots of public figures have learned to their disadvantage that Facebook preserves this and Twitter preserves this. So I think most old archives don't have a sense of urgency to preserve this sort of information, because when you look at, say, old newspapers from the 1960s, they are actually beginning to physically disintegrate. Newspaper doesn't last forever. It does disintegrate. VHS is even a bigger, even more urgent for us, because right now early VHS tapes, videotapes, are beginning to disintegrate, and we will lose that material if we don't act quickly. So I've answered your question by not answering your question, and that's partly because in many respects the status quo is okay, we'll accept the hard drive, we'll put it on the shelf, we'll hope it will be okay. To preserve that, and I clarified with Barry a moment ago, he said it can cost as much as 7,500 euros per terabyte to preserve digital information. I don't know quite why that's so expensive, but for an organization like ALGA, there is no way we could afford to spend 7,500 euros per year preserving one terabyte of information when we have on our desktop 1 5-terabyte drive. Now, I know that doesn't cost us 7,500 euros a year, but we simply back it up. I don't know if other members of the panel have ideas about online media.
Well, to talk for a small archive like Queen, we just close our eyes, honestly, yeah? Because we have not the possibilities, we don't have the money, we don't have the infrastructure to keep all these online material. There is an initiative by the Austrian National Library, at least they save websites, and we have controlled, and they are saving queer websites as well. So we can look into their web archive. But even to save
our correspondence, our email correspondence, we only keep selected letters. So a lot of our correspondence will be lost sooner or later.
Just in terms of website preservation for the English language world, at least, there is the Wayback Machine, which automatically preserves websites. If you are curious about that sort of thing, that's worth investigating. I actually don't know who runs it, and I don't know how it's funded. I think it's a private enterprise thing in the United States.
The National Library of Australia also have their own. They've just kind of launched a new version of the website, so that is more local. So that's good.
And that price is maybe a bit much. If you want it 24/7 accessible. But what I wanted to say is that you have to think about those costs. That it's not only digitization, but also maintenance of the digitized material.
First of all, I would like to thank all five of you for an excellent presentation, and it really gave us a lot of valuable information to take back home. I would like to ask a question that I think all three projects may have something to add to, which is as all of you have been figuring out what it is you actually want to do and how you will get there, I was wondering if you have been looking at the more national and international models, such as Europeana, and both from the standpoint of how you might integrate your metadata, but also in the future, do you see your data ever ending up in larger portals like that?
That's something that I've been considering with Alga's project. As I've been reviewing different options for a database system, I've been looking at whether or not it integrates with the National Library of Australia's Trove project, so that Australian material would be covered via Australia's National Library. I think for ALGA, we want to retain control of our data, and there are also geographic legal issues to be considered there as well. What might be legal in one country might not be legal in another country. What might be considered private in one country may not be considered private in another country. So yes, we're considering sharing. Once you start really opening up to the world, there are other things that you need to think about, like legalities. One of the reasons that I'm here is that because we haven't selected a product yet, I would like to know if there are more products that I haven't considered, and I'm taking notes right throughout this conference to find more products before we commit to one product.
I mean, maybe speaking for the member or for the institutions that we mentioned who are part of QueerSearch, there are definitely collections, some of them that are in part of the Deutsche Digital, the German Digital Library. So there's what Europeana is on a European level, in a German level. There are materials from some of the institutions that are part of the QueerSearch network, and of course other German national level, the Deutsche Digitale Bibliothek, the German National Library, and also the magazine newspaper collection online. In Europeana, I think it is an urgent thing to, when you search for LGBTIQ lives in Europeana, it's devastating, the lack of material, which just shows, I mean, the lack of registration in the participating institutions in Europe that don't include this material. So I think it is up to us. So I think, of course, thinking if we have a wish list for what QueerSearch should and could accomplish, that of course would be one thing, of course, to make those more visible also on a broader level.
Hi, Hi, thanks very much for all of your presentations, and it's really exciting to hear about all of these projects. I'm coming from the Canadian context, and one of the questions/debates that we're talking about a lot in questions of digitization are questions that you raised about the Netherlands project a little bit, questions around privacy and ethics and consent, especially in the with the understanding that the internet is often toxic to queers and trans people, especially those that are negatively racialized and impoverished and migrant and all of those kinds of things. And so my question is really not not a hostile question, not an attack question, but a genuine question around ethics and consent and protocols in the kinds of conversations that you're having within your collectives, within the people whose belongings are in your collections. And I guess ultimately thinking about this balance between like LGBTQ content online and sharing knowledge, balancing that with really long histories of radical consent in queer and trans communities. So again, it's a genuine question, not a hostile question. I'm deeply, deeply curious how you're all dealing with these things.
Yeah, what I said before, and Ilya, you have to have an account to see more deeper material. So we have a website, and that's more general. But if you want to see more about our content, you have to well give your email address and log in. So it's behind the port, behind the door, you can say, our material.
Well, talking for Queen, we have very strict privacy regulations. We still don't have a catalog online, therefore, because we do not know exactly how to manage that technically, what we have saved inside, and what kind of parts of the archive we open to look into. But even participating on a project like Queer Search, it will be always in our hand what we open to the public.
With Project Monty, that's something that we've considered fairly carefully. One of the things that needs to happen for an organization like ELGA is that the rules have to be simple. We can't be too nuanced or too detailed in the rules that we set because we don't have enough people to manage those rules. So we made the rule fairly simple. If you were an organization, we would by default. So in the case of when we hold our funds or archival collections, and I think that's where this is most relevant, if you're an organization, we will assume that we can tell the world that we hold your papers. If you're a person, then we will assume that we can't tell the world that we hold your papers unless you're a public figure. If the opposite is the case, we will happily reverse that. So if you're a private or if you're an organization that wants to remain private, we won't tell the world. If you are an individual who's happy to be known publicly, we'll reverse that situation. When we accept any new donation, we are asking specifically whether or not you are happy for ELGA to tell the world that ELGA holds your material, so that we're actually specifically getting consent when you donate material to ELGA. And one of the technical considerations, which is one of the reasons why I think that Omica won't be good enough for ELGA's catalogue, is that it doesn't provide enough technical facilities to be able to restrict visibility of the material that we hold. So I think for any organization, having a takedown policy is vital, and being able to act on the takedown policy is quickly is also very important, because it very often happens, has to happen within days, if not hours. And actually having thought about it beforehand, before going live, and that was one of the helpful things with this with this project. In our workshops, in requirements, we talked about data security. What's that going to look like? And that's both a technical and a social element. So we've definitely thought about it.
Yes, what I also wanted to say is, and what I told in my lecture, that we don't lend material out to the people, but you can make a list, and then you send it to one of my colleagues, and they will look at it and maybe ask you, why do you want to see this material? And if it's for a non-reason, then maybe they say, no, we don't let you see it. So it's not only that we have things online, that's, well, a small part of our collection, but if you want to see, then it's always that a colleague is checking out why.
Thank you. That was a really brilliant question. Thank you. And I'd be happy to chat more afterwards.
Hi, I'm from the June Mazur Lesbian Archives in West Hollywood, and I'm also a photographer and also a tech person. And I wanted to know if you're aware of something I just became aware of, which is you were talking about at ILIA having photos online that are a certain quality, right? So they're not copied. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, we have thumbnails online, so that are in low quality, but that are pictures of objects or maybe book covers, but not photos from people.
The reason I'm bringing it up is I really recently discovered a free software online that makes thumbnails are probably pretty safe still because they're so small, but we were advised by UCLA, we have a relationship with them, that we should keep our images at 72 DPI. I don't know if anybody else does that or has heard that. But I've recently discovered a software online that's free where you can take an iPhone photo of whatever quality and you can use this software to make it into a 300 DPI. And I've actually had it, actually did it to see if it would work, and it did. And so I'm just a little bit alarmed about that and wanted to pass that information on to you because I think that can change everything in the way that we keep our images more secure and from being used and stolen. As a photographer, I have no rights to my own photos anymore. They're stolen every day on the web, and I'm never given credit. And so as somebody in the archives, it's another thing I just wanted to alert people to, that we may have to develop a new system of protecting our images on websites in many ways. And, you know, using a screenshot, for example, even when you're in a portal, I think you can, you know, if you're sophisticated enough, you can take a screenshot of anything. So I'm just wondering if anybody has any ideas about watermarks or anything else that might help.
I agree with you totally there. For something like Alga's posters collection, we at the moment do not have any of our posters online for that exact reason. We've digitized a lot of our posters to a very high resolution. One of the things that Omeka does is that if you import an image into it, it will automatically generate a thumbnail for you, which is quite low quality, which will let you see what the image is, but on a like that sort of size on the screen. And if you try and blow it up, it'll be pixelated to the point that it's not useful at all. One of the restrictions that I've found with Omeka is that we can't allow people to see the thumbnail but not see the full high-resolution image. And whatever system that we use, we need a system that allows administrators to see the high-res image but members of the public not, because selling rights to use our photos is one of our quite small income streams, but something that we want to make use of. So in terms of a piece of software that will deal with resolutions, could I just clarify something? Was this something that took a low resolution photo and increased its resolution?
Yeah, it was like 72 DPI.
So it took from 72 DPI and took it up to 300 DPI.
Right, and it was a free software online. I can tell you the name. It's the only one I found so far, but it's called IRFAN View. So IRFAN View, and it's free.
I've heard that name before. With digital images, if you start with a very poor quality image, it is very difficult to make it. It's effectively impossible to make it into a high quality image. But it depends on the level of the quality that started to the quality that you're going to. You need to check fairly carefully in terms of dots per inch, DPI, the actual technical details of that, because one 300 DPI image might be quite poor quality in compared to another 300 DPI image. But I take on board entirely the idea that you can improve the quality of an image to the point that it can be stolen and used. Whether or not we use digital watermarks, I don't know, and that's something that Alga still has to think about, and that's been on my list to decide, okay, do we watermark everything, even if it's in thumbnail format?
I was just going to quickly say that I think the only way that you can go from a 72 to a 300 is if you interpolate the file, so that it's essentially inserting additional pixels into, rather than actually increasing the quality, it's increasing the size but not changing the quality. I guess what I wanted to question was just around the German project, and I was just interested to how you're advocating back into that controlled vocabulary that is used by the National Library. Like, is there a, like, you're developing your own, but is there a process of trying to advocate and change that system more broadly?
Well, that is definitely the goal, or that I pointed to. So I wanted to show also that beyond the making visible, connecting, sharing resources, there's also a wider political and social implication in the work that we do in talking about terminology. I don't think very soon we'll get to a point that we agree on a controlled communal vocabulary. I also don't think that's necessary anymore with the type of technology that we have, that we can keep the terminology developed in those institutions. But I do think it would be very helpful to agree as a network, as a joint association, on certain things that need to be changed with that. But we don't have a time frame for that yet. We're still working on, as you saw, early steps of working on establishing the association. Yeah, but that's definitely the goal.
I'm also very interested in the queer search project, and my question is, because you compared the project a little bit to the DDF, the German Women's Archive, Digital Archive, and as I heard yesterday from their talk, it sounded to me like they are also a project of the ministry, and you are applying for foundation by a ministry in Germany. And do you see any negative implications by getting, maybe this is the best place to get a lot of money in Germany, yeah, to do such a project, and I wish good luck for you to get the money, but do you see any negative implications by getting the money and being a project of the ministry?
What was outlined, we don't have the concrete plan to get money from funds from the ministry, and I don't think that is one of the options I think that we're looking at. A big problem really is for an organization or association or project like ours, because we have European countries, Austria and Germany, and we have a non-EU country, Switzerland, it's very hard to get funding for a project like that. So we can't get German funds because it's not only for Germany, we can't get European funds from the European Union because it's not only European Union. So it is a question, still a very open question, how can we combine funds or get together funds to make this project work? I think maybe to specify, I mean, I think the DDF is what we're aiming for is the meta, so to at least have the collections online. The digitalization project, I think, is way ahead of what we're planning for. That might be on the far horizon, but I think getting Meta. I mean, Meta, the lesbian and women and feminist archives in the German speaking world, they've had 20 years of working together and establishing this. So we've just started 2 years ago. So I think there's some time to go. We hope it doesn't take us 20 years to get this running. But I think, yes, there have been talks, of course, about how can we also institutionalize this? What would the implications be if it was, where is the institution based? In which country should it be based? What implications does that have for funding and so forth? And I think, depending on money from ministries that might only have a 5-year span is always also a problem, because after the 5 years end, what do you do then with the infrastructure that needs to be maintained, and how do you do that? Yeah, so those are definitely talks that we're having.
Probably wrap up now, but I just wanted to remind everyone that there is a caucus for small community archives today. I'm pretty sure it's in the afternoon break. Is it, or has it changed? I know Graham Willett will know. 2:30 in the afternoon, and so that's quite relevant to a lot of our presenters. And yeah, we can continue the conversation there, and also over coffee, which is all free upstairs on the roof. And then also help yourself to all of the food. There's lots of food. In the breaks. And there's films, of course, tonight. Lots of documentary films. So I look forward to continuing the conversation. And thank you again, everyone.